You are listening to Prometheus by Minute. I'm your host, Connor Coulson. This is Minute 92. This minute opens on Shaw saying, "Come in," before Yannick enters, and ends with saying, "Right," after Yannick says he doesn't care. Yannick bursts into the room, half-dressed in the same blue and orange compression suit that Shaw is wearing. Now, he doesn't go out again, so clearly he's undressing from the previous scene we saw him in which he incinerated Fifield. This threw me off for a moment, but it really has only been a few minutes of screen time since that happened, and logistically less than an hour has passed within the film's world. It's just so much has happened since then that it feels like much more time has passed. Yannick does some expositing. He says this planet is an installation, perhaps of the military kind. The black goo is clearly a weapon of mass destruction, and so on. But again, what is your evidence for this? I know I've come back to this over and over again, but all they know is black goo equals bad. Handling uranium with your bare hands is also bad. Doesn't mean it is used only as a weapon, it's also an energy source and has many other applications. Mutagen may be the same thing, and that's why they needed to manufacture it off-world, and maybe there was an accident that wiped them all out like Chernobyl. There's really about equal evidence for both hypotheses. The science fiction author Robert Heinlein, in his novel Stranger in a Strange Land, created a profession called a fair witness, which is an individual trained to observe events and report exactly what he or she sees and hears, making no extrapolations or assumptions. And that's what I'm attempting to do here. The evidence the film presents, and the narrative the film wants us to believe, don't exactly match up, and it's unreasonable to assume these human characters know anything more than we do. However, this scene might make a little more sense, with the additional context of the deleted conversation Yannick has with Vickers. You see how he comes to this conclusion, and it's reasonable to assume a man with his military history would jump to this conclusion. It says more about his character than any truth behind LV-223, but that is still valuable within the narrative. It also gives Yannick more to do. I can remember from a young age being fascinated by the concept of bit-part characters. In my own writing, I like to be very economical and only have a handful of characters, and each one gets a fair amount of attention. But in ensemble movies, like the Alien films, there are a lot of minor players. And I guess what interests me is what roles they serve within the story. Are they just padding out a group or crowd, or are they there to serve a function? Usually this function is one very specific thing. And when an actor is involved as opposed to a book, I like to know how they approach it and what they bring to it. So Idris Elba is, of course, a fantastic actor, a natural leading man. It's clear he tried to imbue Yannick with a lot of life. Much like Vickers, I feel like these are characters who ended up being too big for the screen time they were given. But that's not a bad thing if you've only got a handful of scenes. Make them count. Make this character meaningful and memorable. That's a really powerful tool in storytelling in general. Give us a sense of a bigger world. Leave us wanting more. Get our imaginations going. Even though the prequels are supposedly answering it all, they aren't, really. They just raise more questions, which is exhilarating. For every new glimpse we get, it opens up more mysteries, and that's probably what has kept me coming back to discuss these films over and over again since Covenant was released nearly 3 years ago. Oh my god. Yannick is all in favor of leaving immediately, and before he leaves the room, Shaw says, "One of them is still alive. Don't you want to know what they have to say?" Yannick says he doesn't care. To me, this line has more depth there than it appears at first. I think this minute reflects the bigger themes of the film. You have someone wanting to hear what their creator has to say, and the other who doesn't care. It is the timeless, uneasy relationship between creator and creation. In nature, life begets life. It is a near mindless process. Even for the smartest animals, a raven or an orca does not ask its parents why it was created. Well, as far as we know. We can say for certain that this has never happened amongst the octopus families, because Dad swims away after the fun bit is done, and Mum protects the eggs with her life, quite literally, until she starves to death. She will only ever produce one clutch of eggs in her lifetime, which is only about 3 to 5 years. Whether they are fertilized or not, mind you. This marks the end of her life. Again, all pure instinct. She's a very smart creature, but she doesn't seem to understand that she is sacrificing her life for empty, unfertilized eggs. But with human beings, things are very different. When we bring life into this world, it is, well, should be, a conscious choice. Yes, humans can be blinded by instinct and hormones just as any other beast, but once that wears off, we continue to parent with the higher regions of our brains. Or so one would hope. I once asked my mother why she had me, what she had hoped I would become, and what my purpose was. You know, I really thought, hey, you know, this could be a really interesting, just a philosophical discussion and understanding the difference between maybe what a parent envisions for the life of their child versus the reality. Well, all she did was snap at me and say, it's not my fault you turned out the way you did. Whoa, okay, what is that supposed to mean? And it's been a few years, and I've had time to think about it. And I believe what she meant to say, in her limited way, was that she must feel some guilt over the fact that I have been sick and disabled practically since birth. Life has not exactly been kind on me, but I'm okay with that. I'm pretty happy, to be honest. Life is what you make of it. Creating life, honestly, must be a surreal and terrifying experience. The closest thing I can understand to this feeling is a feeling I get at the beginning of Alien Covenant or when I read Frankenstein. Oh, okay, this thing is alive, and I made it. Now what? It is a level of responsibility scarcely experienced in any other aspect of life. Everything this creation suffers, everything this creation does, for good or ill, reflects on you. I can almost understand the antinatalists, as I mentioned in an earlier episode, their whole stance of, you know, you bring this person into the world only to suffer. Why would you do that? I mean, that's kind of an extreme end of it, but yeah, I can't even imagine what it must be like to give birth to something, someone, and, well, I don't know, in the case of aliens, something. But yes, giving birth to someone and just going, oh yeah, this is alive and can think for itself. Ugh, terrifying. But the reality is your children are their own people, with their own lives and thoughts and desires, sometimes radically different from your own. It is the uncanny valley of familiarity. This person is both an extension of your very biology, and at the same time a complete stranger. I think a lot of parents struggle with that. And tying that back into Prometheus, this is why Yannick does not care. This is why it doesn't matter what his creators have to say. Because nothing your creator says to you is likely going to have any real meaning for you personally. Your creator can only ever see you as their creation, and all the things they intended for you and intended for you to become. Meeting God would likely be a disappointment, just as meeting Wayland is not exactly thrilling for David. And looking at it from the other perspective, I think the engineers are those disappointed parents who had a very specific plan for humanity, and instead of simply accepting this new life for what it was, they rejected them. Supposing that is what actually happened. I am trying to be a fair witness, after all. I think the only way creator and creation, parent and child, can have a harmonious relationship is if the parent accepts their child absolutely, or both parties are just compatible with mutual interests. You know, your child wants to take over the family business, they only seem to date people you approve of and get along with, etc., etc. So it's either selflessness or pure luck. If the engineers rejected us, clearly we were not compatible, and they do not see us as people in our own right, but as an extension of their will and ambition. Not great parents, in short. So the scripts were a little bit ahead with Paradise, but when we last left the engineer script, Watts/Shaw, had just been impregnated by a facehugger. She wakes up and gets herself back to the Prometheus, or the Magellan, as it is in this case. The extraction scene plays out almost identically to the final version. Evidently, this is one of those key scenes they had plotted from the earliest days. Those of you who write fiction, you probably know what I mean. Your story begins with a handful of major moments you really want to write, and then you build the story out from there. Although it's a shame how often those scenes either don't make it into the final product, or it changes so dramatically from the original version. Like, damn it, do I have to write another story now so I can actually get that scene? Ah. Well, in the case of Ridley Scott, I guess he does. There are ideas that didn't make it into Alien. And he saved them up for like 30 years and worked their way into Prometheus or even Alien Covenant. Now, the question is, in this version, why is the med pod here? So in this case, it is literally just Vickers has a really fancy medical pod because it doesn't say it's only for male patients. And Wayland isn't here. Wayland is apparently dead. He doesn't come back at any point in this story. So, how do I feel about that? That is one of those things that definitely changed and became more sophisticated in later scripts. And that's quite interesting to see. I'll talk more about that later. The other detail is that the chestburster is in her womb. It was a face hugger. It was on her face. It didn't go any further south than that. So what's it doing so far down there? In the final version, you know, it makes sense. She was impregnated vaginally. That's how it got in there. So I'm surprised at the order of how that idea evolved, I guess. The only major difference in the surgery scene is how it ends. So Shaw passes out after the extraction, and when she awakens, the alien is outside of the med pod and has killed Vigoda. You know, there's blood and mess everywhere. It's not exactly described what this creature looks like, but presumably it's just a xenomorph or neomorph type thing. All it says is it has a pale, eyeless head, which, you know, even though the xenomorph is black, the head is pale or clear, so. The scene is played more for campy action, so get this. Shaw gets up and grabs Vigoda's gun. So she's like, slowly waking up, like, what the shit? Oh no, there's a xenomorph or something. So she rolls out of the med pod, grabs the gun, and then just blasts the xenomorph with all it's got. And, you know, acid blood sprays everywhere, but not on Shaw, amazingly. And it opens up a hole, and the creature's body falls into the deck below. So, yeah. That's different. And then Shaw gets dressed, reaches the bridge, and finds Yannick. And the following exchange is the most 1980s action movie conversation I have ever read. Yannick says, Vickers said you were dead. Watts says, I was. She lets the jacket fall open to reveal her bandaged midriff. Yannick takes that in grimly. So, there's two things on my ship now. Watts says, no. I brought it in. Hef's a gun. I took it out. I can just imagine a theme kind of like the Terminator or the RoboCop one. It's just like, I took it out. Dun, 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 dun. Like, calm down. And so they're in the bridge and the rest of the crew is holed up in the bridge as well. This is because, of course, the whole ship has been torn apart by aliens. Shaw sees Vickers from across the room and then she walks up and punches her in the face. And Vickers is like, what was that for? And Shaw is like, what? It's like, Protocol 2. Which again was some dumb shit. It's just, this is more 80s than Aliens. In this story, David doesn't look very human. I don't know why, but I always imagine some combination of that robot from Red Dwarf and Max Headroom. In the script, Watts knows what David did to her. So there isn't any of that weird chemistry there. And let's be honest, the weird chemistry is the fun part. The script also removes any ambiguity. The engineers made the mutagen and the xenomorphs as weapons to kill humanity. No doubt about it. And that's no fun. There's no Wayland, there's no plan to talk to an engineer. They just can't leave because David has overridden the controls for the ship. This is why I love reading early drafts. The general concepts are there, but there are a lot of important ingredients missing. In this case, compelling motivations. I also think that's why it's unfair to call this engineer script superior to the film. It's really not. It has a lot of issues of its own. Different issues, mind you, but issues nonetheless. And as I was mentioning before, with the med pod, you know, the inclusion of that feels like a Chekhov's gun situation, but it's just kind of missing something. It's like, oh, well, Vickers has a med pod. Yep, and then you use the med pod. It's just a little bit too straightforward. I mean, you can do that. There's nothing wrong with that. But a story is much more satisfying when you've got all these elements coming together. Everything's building up nicely. You know, that's why stories are so much more satisfying than reality. And so in this case, the MedPod isn't just because has a fancy medical device. No, it is foreshadowing that Wayland is still alive, you know, and it shows, oh, that it is only calibrated for male patients. Oh, okay, then there's a mystery here. You know, having that mystery there, having this element of uncertainty, or having these bits and pieces of a puzzle that you can put together, even if it's obvious, it is fun. It is engaging. I think an example of something that's foreshadowed but doesn't have that much complexity actually comes from the Alien franchise. In Aliens, we see that power loader being used by Ripley just to load some heavy things onto the ship. And then in the third act, she uses it to fight the alien queen. Now, there's no deeper subplot going on with that power loader. It's just, well, here it is. You know what this thing is, and you're going to see it later, and it's going to play a major role. Again, there's really nothing wrong with just having, this is a device, and later on it's going to be used. That's it. But, I mean, come on. I think the MedPod subplot is benefited by actually conveying a little bit more information of, hang on, only male patients? What? What's going on here? And then you meet Wayland, you're like, oh, okay, that explains that. Even though, as I've said, that whole keeping Wayland secret until the third act, I don't see a purpose, but at least it is adding some complexity and a bit of mystery. And I wouldn't say it's needless. You know, that was the common complaint about, like, Inception, movies like that, where it's not sophisticated, they're just making it needlessly convoluted. That's not the same thing. And, yeah, I mean, Prometheus kind of walks that line, especially with this particular, the MedPod and Wayland subplot. Is this making things more interesting, or is it making things more convoluted? I think it's pretty straightforward to follow, so I think it's not convoluted in that sense, but it is convoluted in the sense where you go, well, but what was the point? The crew head out to the Juggernaut to regain control of David. They think he will still have to obey Vickers if he hears her verbal commands. One cool detail in the following scenes is that they found these engineer lenses earlier on, and a crew member, appropriately named Glass, turns them into goggles, which Shaw wears so she can navigate all the things in the engineer structure that is only visible to them, like their interfaces. The crew encounter another xenomorph, it's not fully grown, and then they find David. I'll leave it here for now, but as we can see, the third act is a radical departure, and I much prefer the story we got in the film. You know, the engineer script is a very direct Alien prequel, and, you know, it's about this is where the xenomorph comes from, and here's a crazy android trying to join the engineers, and it's just, well, we will see in further scenes it becomes even more, you know, Saturday morning cartoonish, especially David, he's basically Skeletor by the end. I'm much happier with the final product that, for all its flaws, I think it is much more sophisticated, it is more ambiguous, and in that ambiguity, as we've seen in this podcast, it provides a lot of room for discussion and debate and imagination. Whereas the engineer script, to me, is very straightforward. It's just a straightforward action movie. I don't think there's anything of deeper philosophical significance there. There's not as much to discuss because it pretty much tells you everything outright. Another detail worth noting is the orrery is prominently featured. No surprise there, as it is another key scene that this story was likely shaped around from the beginning. And one final note, just before I started recording this, longtime listener Michael Giamarino pointed something out from the previous minute. You know how I said Shaw doesn't pray? Well, Michael reminded me that there was a trailer showing her doing just that in front of the sink, in that very scene. I can only assume it was edited out because, as I said, the effect in the final film is an ambiguous one, and the emphasis is placed on her loss of Charlie, and faith doesn't seem to play a big part in it, and I think that was for the best. Alright, that about covers it. This is Coulson signing off. You can find me on TravianDesigns.com, TravianDesigns, or Prometheus by Minute on Facebook. Thanks once again to patrons Mark Boder and Tariq, and if you would also like to become a Patreon supporter, head on over to patreon.com/TravianDesigns. There's also a link to the Patreon through my website.